the times and the days, through the inquiries, of course, and small groups, one-to-one. Each and every person has been relating and experiencing and communicating their experience, sometimes, of course, being felt from inside, attending to that, sometimes from the outside, from one of the three of us. And in that, it's a situation, whether it's from the inside or the outside, both, of bringing light to bear on experience, bringing light to bear on the experience of life. And hopefully, from within or from without, enabling and allowing experience to stand up and stand out, to gain some genuine clarity, insight and understanding about it. And for that to stand out, we've had, of course, the support of each day and each one of us, the support of the silence, the meditation methods and techniques, the various tools and activities, all of it keeping in touch and true to what the experience is of the day, of the hour, of the moment. We've also noticed that during periods of time, it has been challenging in the way of certain areas and things which have arisen. And to that degree, there's also a development taking place. We may or may not be conscious of it in terms of important and invaluable qualities of mind. One of them that referred to a moment ago, of course, is the area of patience. And patience, that capacity to stay steady with what is, with what's happening all the way through. One of the obvious, or two of those obvious areas where the quality of patience is being developed and cultivated, and would be towards the end of a sitting period. And so for some, the last 10 or 15 minutes seems like a long wait into eternity in waiting for the bell to ring. And one notices and sees in oneself, are there ripples, are there waves? What's the quality of patience like from one moment to the next? In this case, patience, the ability to bear circumstances until they happen. Capacity in life to bear steady with circumstances until it happens. And patience in the position of the various qualities or affections of mind, it comes first on the list of quality of patience. But patience also arises, and many of you will know and have experienced, in other forms. And one, of course, is in the one-to-one meetings, or sometimes the absence of them, in the room upstairs or outside with the child. And a number of you have made appointments, or whatever it might be, or be told come later and come at this time, and it's been a tremendous exercise in patience, acceptance, tolerance, and many other qualities of mind are being developed or rapidly lost in the wait for the one-to-one. And again, sometimes and quite often in such circumstances, the experience going on outside the room, waiting for the one-to-one, can be considerably more insightful than when getting into the room for the one-to-one, because more can be going on out in one's mind outside the door than what's going on inside of it. And others may have experienced some fear or nervousness or agitation. Situations like this are just set up for authority figures and all that goes along with it. So as I was speaking to one person today, some who after 1, 2, 3, 4 retreats, never put their name down for an interview, and when they do think that they might do it, walk up to the notice board and find that there's no spaces left and feel incredible relief. So again, the relationship to external circumstances in terms of the authority figures in life, there are other situations here as well, in not always easy one-to-one, as it is with other circumstances of life. There are others who find it difficult, and qualities of mind developed, mindfulness, letting go, patience, in small group meetings. And for some, there's a kind of number, not necessarily conscious, but a number in the mind of how many one can cope with when speaking up. So if there's a small group meeting of half a dozen, six or seven people, for some they will say, well, that feels more manageable, like, you know, you say something at that time. And then it goes up to 10, and then today 15, 18, or whatever it might be. As the numbers goes up, the confidence correspondingly goes down, and does show and reflect how difficult it can be to develop qualities of mind, and where there's nervousness, where there is apprehension, where there is fear to act, to deal with, to act, to respond to. And there are others of you who, in the inquiry sessions that we have had over the days, will look towards others and see others speak up, whether it's a shorter inquiry or a longer period of inquiry, and thoughts will arise, my goodness, I could never do that. You can never speak up and speak to others here and far. I can never speak about my experience in such a personalized way or whatever. And some know at some point on one of these dreadful retreats that one will have to come and one will have to be in the inquiry, and all the resistance holding back, no, I'm not ready for this, I don't want to do this, I'm not exposing myself to him or the others or whatever. And sometimes one knows one has to do that, just cut through that. And it is, for some, it can be, regardless of the content, regardless of what they actually say, quite a significant changing and turning point in releasing an acknowledgement and a recognition. But it is, in this case, to speak up in our group. Some of you, of course, are so used to this, don't give it a second thought. You're used to the classroom, you're used to lecturing, you're used to public meetings or whatever it might be, and don't get any whiff of unpleasant sensations, butterflies in the stomach, or whatever. But some do. And again, qualities of mind, speaking up, expressing oneself, and part of the significance of all of that is verbal people have too much influence in this world, and the talkers have too much sway, and it's necessary and rather important that people who tend to be more restrained and more silent and not outspoken in any way to remember your voice, so that voice of wisdom and kindness and thoughtfulness can really matter. And I know, and possibly some of you do as well, that sometimes we're in meetings, committee meetings and other things that deal with your mind, and a person or two in such meetings may say very, very little. And it might mean that some people do have within themselves the wish, in fact, to wait to be invited. In other words, not easy in freedom of speech, which is a great freedom of life, and we're blessed to have it in our culture, to actually use that freedom to express oneself. And as I say, sometimes we have a tendency to be wait to invite it, and therefore it's quite necessary, from sensitivity and respect, from mindfulness and alertness, to actually notice who are the quiet ones in our circles, who are the ones whose voice we hardly notice. Perhaps she or he has a great deal of wisdom to offer, and maybe we just need to ask what it is, and to ask. And I can think, if I may say, of situations myself in committee meetings, as an example of what I have in mind. Sometimes a person says very, very little, and yet what he or she says really has something really of value to say. And it's all too easy for the talkers just to ride over that person, not really hear that one line statement. So again, in receptivity, in clarity of mindfulness, in clear awareness, this area of right, skillful speech really matters a great deal. and it's certainly as important a practice as sitting cross-legged every day. Probably is not a teaching on earth like the Buddha's, who has given so much emphasis, discussion, exploration of what skillful, wise speech is. So much attention being given to what is the intention for the right person, right place, right subject, right time, to what the impact is in life of backbiting, gossiping, malicious speech, unkind speech, what it is to speak and know who is the speaker, what it is to speak and know what the consequences of speech are, what are 40 different things not to speak about because it generates confusion. So the text gives incredible teachings about what it is to speak, because as we know and as we see, language has its impact on the psyche. The transmission and the flow of words from mouth to ear and from pen to paper or whatever have an impact. And so in the areas of mindfulness in life, in the areas of wisdom and skillfulness in life, words have a relationship to all of that. And it's a real practice. Sometimes it's taken as a bit too extremes. And I remember in the monastery, one of the monks, doing his right speech practice, and would stop in the middle of talking and would say, I've just lost my mindfulness, and so I'm going into silence from this point on. And so we'd be halfway through something, and then we were all left high and dry because he decided that he'd lost his mindfulness and therefore he'd return to silence, and so we'd have to walk off because he, etc. So this would not be the best way to get on with one's partner. So in looking at speech and the flow of speech, the influence, it might be a good way actually, in the flow of speech, to really include it in a really clear and conscientious way. In that, we talked about thoughts, we talked about language, there's a certain kind of sequence to track and to follow in ourselves with regard to this. And that is, there are feelings and perceptions. Feelings and perceptions give rise to thoughts. The thoughts give rise to speech, to communication. Sometimes, obviously, it doesn't always go through in that way. But in that movement from the inner to the outer, there's a flow which takes place. When that flow has an excess of I in it, that I begins to have an impact on the other. We've all experienced a situation where it's wrong time, wrong place, wrong subject, and wrong person that we're speaking, and we're speaking I, my. And the other person, one can see the slump in their shoulders, body beginning to collapse under the weight of the I and my of somebody else's talking. And if, as an example, in England, you're talking to somebody for some minutes and you hear the word interesting, please retranslate this word as meaning you are boring me completely out of my mind. But it's interesting. All right. So in the movement of impact and flow and contact there's something naturally questionable which we have when too much of I and my, which is going on in existence, and with it, of course, we get increasingly out of touch with the one who is listening. There's some people, and you may be similar to myself, that of course in fields of service, of course, and various forms, of course, listening to the situation of people's lives is important, and keeping in touch with experience is important. But sometimes we insist that people hear our story. Insist. And we may, plenty of times, have a necessity, a capacity to say, no, And I remember one situation in the United States, where else, where a person was came in and sat down. And some people, of course, are in psychotherapy and therefore quite used to the 45-minute period. It used to be 55 minutes 20 years ago, then it was cut to 50 minutes. And now here they're talking in meetings in the States to cut it to 45 minutes. But I notice they're not cutting the rate correspondingly. But anyway, it's lovely girls. And the person came for a one-to-one. And the person said, I had this incredible dream, incredibly vivid dream, and really want to tell you about it. And I said, well, I really don't want to hear about it. And they said, no, because you really have to listen. And I said, well, you promise me one thing, that you'll keep it very short, just very short, 10-minute session. So, as we got into about the 9th minute, I was sitting in a chair, and as I was sitting in the chair, gradually a kind of tiredness was coming over me. And it's a true story. And while he was relating the story, I fell asleep. And I went like this. I literally faded. Fell asleep. I thought it was quite lovely. And he kind of coughed and said to me, was I boring you? So I just use it as an example in the flow of contact and communication. It's not only in the listener to the listener, the communication, the speaker to who are spoken through. And that communication, awareness embraces the duality. Awareness is embracing the duality. And if all the interest is on the focus of I, the person in the duality of speaker and spoken to, on the other end of that, just becomes a kind of object. There's no interest or concern or focus or prioritizing or connecting with. It's all I, self, and connecting with. And sometimes, I know those who speak publicly as well, in the apparent duality of speaker and spoken to, or however we phrase it, quite often. Yes, sometimes people fade out while they're listening, they're turning their head round, as some of you are doing, and having a look at what the responses are, if any, of others. And sometimes people fade out, put their head on their knees, and disappear. And so, quite regularly, not that I've done it on this retreat, but at other times, I've just said something, out of life, with head on your knees, or whatever. It's remarkable, the rapid speed that the head suddenly flies up, or whatever, and others daydream, and then I can see that they're tired or out to lunch or looking forward to it or whatever it might be, and then I'll throw in a one line or a couple of lines joke, usually a lousy joke, and others will laugh, and then this person will come back and say, God, I missed it. So in the awareness and the communication, still there's a dynamic going on, and in the dynamic it's we are receiving as the listener and that which is spoken to us. We are the speaker and one who is spoken to, and this interplay can be a world of great clarity and sharing. But as we know, if there isn't any wisdom, a lot of pain, a lot of disappointment, a lot of hurt, a lot of blaming, lot of anxiety or whatever. And so how very easily in a dualism of between two people or more, that's in that dualism, if we can't hold the dual, we can't embrace and accommodate the dual, there'll be a tendency towards leaning all our way. It's called being argumentative. Leaning all towards our version of reality. It's being one-sided. Leaning towards our fixed position. And in all of that, it generates its own blindness. Non-dual teachings, the understanding of them, the liberating aspect of them, is that it embraces the dual. And one of the major duals of life is self and other. Now some say, but if I just adopt that in my communications with others, I'll become passive. How can I possibly have such an outlook when I'm a lawyer advocating rights, and I'm in opposite to others who have a different position? How can I, when I'm advocating for something or other which matters, which one feels is fair and right and just, how can I take this non-dual position when I have a genuine and authentic interest in advocating and, as it were, winning the argument, so to speak? The attitude, or the Buddhist teaching, the Buddha advised into tremendous depth here. Any knowledge of the Eightfold Path will tell you what I'm telling you this evening. That the attitude which goes along, which gives support to the language, matters a great deal. And in that attitude, there's a particular principle which gives support to the attitude. And the particular principle is, very simple but vital, speaking that which is true and useful. It takes a wisdom to know that. Sometimes we know what is true, and through our experience, through our observation, and then we go and tell somebody, but it's of no use to them. They can't do anything with it. A person or people might feel completely devastated by it. They might make them feel very hurt or angry or withdrawal or whatever. Why? Because we haven't learned in life to understand the relationship of the duality of life between the speaker and the listener and the speaker. Why? Because we need to observe and be aware of others as much as ourselves. Because we live together, obviously. Therefore, can I have not some kind of moralistic vow, but in my relationship of the dual, or the kind I'm speaking of, can I in that learn to watch with tremendous interest the to-ing and fro-ing of that movement? That doesn't deny my rights as a human being of the free speech. Doesn't deny me the opportunity in life to express what I feel and see, what is true and useful to speak. The Buddha made a comment, and he once said, it can sound very conceited, since I didn't know him, he might be, I don't know, but nonetheless, he said, I am not in dispute with others, so others may be in dispute with me. Without fault. Who's he kidding? But if one might think that, but if one has a sense of the skillfulness of communication as a daily life practice, committed to speaking both what is true and useful, the feeling that comes and the sensitivities come, that one doesn't feel one is in dispute with others, one doesn't feel one's in conflict with others, one is speaking what one sees and understands and takes responsibility for it in terms of the communication of one's feel it's true and useful. One of the capacities that we have to know how clear we are in life, how clear heart is and mind is in life, is when dispute from others come, when blame comes, resentment comes, threats come, or whatever it might be, how is the capacity to hear what is true and useful? Despite the barrage of blame that may come. there will be aggression that may come. It might be total projection off the wall. Can one stand steady with it? If one can't, and one begins to absorb others' criticisms, others' hostility, others' blame, it will place pressure in the emotions. It has to. It will land in the feelings. And the feelings will begin to absorb and feel weighed with it. A heaviness will be inside. And with pressure, and all the things that one feels one has to do, will create an imbalance, and the imbalance will create panic inside, anxiety inside, wave inside. Therefore, I say, it is a practice to see ways that we can listen with blame, dispute, whatever is thrown back at us, or whatever it might be, and learning to stay steady with it as a practice. So that even when we are in dispute with another person, and there's real differences going on, one has got enough presence of mind to stand steady with it. To give you a small example that comes to mind, not unusual in this world. I was some years ago. It is sometimes in life things make an impression on us, and we remember. This is one. I was in the car park, the local supermarket, and the car pulled out of the car space, and I drove straight into it, not knowing, not seeing, and not realizing that another car was just about to reverse into it. And so I got in out of my car, closed the door, and this guy got out of the car, if I may say, a huge beast of a man. And said to me, if I was in England, I would quote word for word, but I tend to be the polite Englishman. But he said to me, if you don't get your effing car out of here quickly, and so I stood there and I said, I'm not moving under a tray. And he got closer. Close enough to smell his repulsive breath. And he said, if you don't get your effing car out of here right away, I'm going to smash your effing face in. So I said, for that I am not moving one step. If you ask, request, I'll move. But never under threat. And he was heaving. And as usual, a small little crowd was watching. Kind of the gunfight at the OK Corral or something like that. And he took a few deep breaths and said, with incredible pressure, please move your car! And it's not like these two people are in dispute with each other. Why not? Can they interpret and view that way? But as I say, sometimes with our silence, with shortage of words, with standing our ground, with keeping faith with a certain principle of life, never to be pushed and pulled around by the violence and aggression of other people, that sometimes we have to stand the ground. In that willingness to stand the ground, it doesn't guarantee any protection. No assurance of that. Guy could have come and just boom. And I would have been talking to you this evening without my front teeth. Of course, society has taken care of that problem. So, yet standing steady in the face of, I say, is a practice with a capital P. And it needs at times checking in with the body, checking in with the feelings, checking in with the sensations, checking in with the heat of the body that naturally arises when under threat and under pressure there. Can we, with all of that, stay cool inwardly, even if the body is feeling hot as I was under the armpits because of the situation? Small things of life, small gestures of life, give the skills, the capacity to work with others in the sum, of course, miserable little threat compared to the threat that some people have to endure and experience in their life. Tiny, infinitesimally small one. In the duality which takes place in our life, the duality gives some sense of separation. Talked about this together over the days. And similarly, as the observer of the observed, the witness of the witnessed, the duality for those who are devotional between oneself as a devotee and devotion to God or whatever it might be, all gives an implication, a sense of the duality. And sometimes there is experience of the fading away of the duality. One does feel, and it might arise quite spontaneously, a real sense of unity, of oneness. And that may just be when we've been sitting in the hall, and instead of being me, whoever the me is, me and them, as it might have been on the first day or two, or at other times, it's us. Not in a shallow way, but us, togetherness, a sense of unity, a sense of commonality, despite all our differences. And those awarenesses and appreciations and acknowledgements are important. Build a sense of unity. It helps to weaken the duality of self and other, so vital. Sometimes, in some teachings, not in this one, one will hear the language of unity as though it was the ultimate truth, as though the diversity and the differences and the self and other was the relative truth, and the experience, might be a very profound experience, of oneness is the ultimate truth. Ultimately, everything, all is one, or whatever. But, all too easily, we may have great, wonderful experiences of oneness. That fades away, and then we're back into two-ness, and three-ness, and four-ness, and five-ness, and six-ness, and seven-ness, and whatever, and then sickness. Really. So, in experiences which take place, such as oneness, or the experiences of incredible diversity in this world, phenomenal, inwardly and outwardly, of anything, species, all the things that you and I know. All of that is also important here to attend to you. There's also a duality. A duality which says, at times, hopefully regularly and beautifully, I really have a wonderful experience of oneness. Really feeling one with life, one with the moment, one with nature, one with my family, one with my friends, one with the universe, or whatever. Really, a feeling of oneness is an important feeling for us. It helps to reduce the ego and egotism, which has inflated itself. It helps to give that sense of kind of shared equality. Not having in life such big hierarchies in life that we have made as human beings, which is a misunderstanding. Not to say that everything is equal, and not to make a hierarchy. They're just views, torment life. So sometimes they say, what incredible oneness, without a hierarchy, without all the differences. And at other times, we may acknowledge and see the diversity. And you see the diversity of things through our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, touch, feelings, thoughts, experiences, etc. All the diversity. It's a duality which our life moves, can move between one and the other. All too often, the other is all too common, in which the assumed reality of existence is, I am here, this is the self, and there are objects which come to the self, there are objects which come to me, called sentient and insentient, to use Buddhist language, to call alive and dead, to call matter and mind, whatever you might want to say. The common view in the culture, in the environment, is there is self, and in this self, things come and go to it. And out of all the objects which keep coming to me, I pick a few of them out, and I say they're important, and others I don't pick out, and they're less important. And the assumption is that that experience is true reality. I'm living this world, and things are happening to me from what's around me and what's in me. That really is true reality. It's not true reality. It's not unreal. It's not, as the Buddhists would say, what's unreal would be a cow flying through the air. If you see that, then psychotherapy quickly. Or horns on a rabbit's head, these are the two. They would say, son of a barren woman, that's another one they dug out of the text, or whatever. In other words, unreality is what doesn't have any existence by conventional agreement. But we make the mistake of transferring and thinking self and objects, me and that, me, this, that and the other, that's true reality. Our senses and experiences of oneness, more, as I've said a couple of times now, water that down. It should sober us a little bit more, so that we're not living in this drunken condition of misperception. Self and others are the true way things really, really are. If we allow ourselves a little questioning of that, not reducing it to an unreality, which is foolish and naive, it's a way of looking and perceiving. By agreement, by communication, by language, by everyday experiences. So the sense of oneness acts as something, as an antidote to it. In the antidote to it, what is it that is embracing both? What is it that enables both to be acknowledged, to be received, to be experienced, to be known, to be felt, to be confirmed with language or whatever? Can't be the oneness. I'm in the privilege of the Dharma talking here, but that's sympathetic acceptance. This is one of the hot words of meditation retreats, and it can be useful and beneficial, but it seems to be the answer for everything. So, so there is the oneness, there is the diversity. You just want to bring a little question into this solidity of view. Had some experience of other ways of sensing and feeling life, the full moon that's there, the night sky, life unfolding itself, the mystery and the wonder of it all, the apparent unity of it all. Knowing that, letting that inform life, letting it act as an agent to cool out the ego and self, self, self. Yes, what is it that embraces all of this? What is it that enables and makes it all possible? Therefore, even in this simple duality called speaker and listener, called witness and witnessed, such as in meditation or whatever, called oneness and diversity. All of this is like, it would seem unwise to make and claim one as the true ultimate reality and then and negate the other. That's what the mind will tend to do. And some teachers advocate unity as the ultimate reality. But others would advocate subatomic particles, the ultimate reality, or things and self as the ultimate reality, or whatever. What is it that accommodates both, makes it all possible? Which embraces all of it extraordinarily. And no matter what goes on with our life, confusion, doubts, clarity and anxiety, conviction and uncertainty, security and insecurity, movement of the inner life, movement of bodily life, movement of events through eyes, ears, nose, tongue and touch, doesn't have any impact whatsoever. No matter what. No matter what. The world is here, we all faded away. Something, but what is that which makes it all possible? And various ways we touch upon that, etc., etc. So finally, in the listening, if one takes the text, Dharma text, spiritual texts, Upanishads, and men and women in ancient India left their homes, their towns, their villages, and they would hear of a sage and go and lend near, maybe in a cave or at the edge of the village or in the jungle or whatever. It was sitting and listening to themes and threads as we have been doing here together over the days. And one of the beautiful and significant things of all of this is sometimes we say, and we ourselves could give that impression, we must go deeper. We spoke a lot about going deep. But if one takes texts, teachings over the centuries, and some of us who have a very good knowledge of the text and the kind of questions, in fact, Charles and I were looking at one or two books in our room, many of the same questions and concerns, many things, which have been raised here, obviously have been raised 10 years ago, 100 years ago, 500 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, etc. Same question, same search, same interest, same explorations going on. As a general track record in these various texts over 3,000 years or more, East and West, one only has to think of Socrates and the inquiries which took place, very similar to what we have here, etc. The track record shows that in the listening, much transformation takes place in just the listening. And the beauty of it is, one doesn't have to have any deep experience. One doesn't have to have had great depths of insight into moment-to-moment change. One doesn't have to have had a tremendous capacity to look at the space between the thoughts or all the other things that you and I have discussed and looked at. For some, in the listening, it became clear there was and is, and knowing that it's clear, and knowing that one is free. And one cannot say, God, I had an incredible volcanic explosion which blew my mind to pieces. One cannot say I had this incredible limitation in the middle of the talk which uplifted me out of my old self, or whatever, that nothing dramatic happened, the cells didn't start buzzing, that the chakras didn't start spinning, or the energy kundalini didn't start rising up and cracking the ceiling. Nothing happened. Yet, freedom is realized, awakening is known, it's there. It's not intellectual, it's not conceptual, it's not just an idea. It doesn't just become, oh, that happened to me on the last evening of that retreat that I did, whatever it was. And yet nothing dramatic, significant, explosive, or whatever has happened between head and toes, whatever, yet there is a knowing, and that knowing is steady, a free human being, or however one wishes, being with God, living with God, however, whatever language you're comfortable with. And it's expressed in daily life. And no explosive, dramatic, great insight or whatever took place, yet nevertheless. And when one reads the old text, when one listens to teaching, when one looks at the way of the flow of the tradition, that happens again and again and again. And that's why some come for the day for meditation, but it's in the evening talk for some, it's in the inquiry for others, it's in the one-to-one for others, it's in the small group for others, or whatever it might be, or it's in the silence for others, and in the meditation, clarity, knowing, freedom of being come. And one is seen through mythologies of egotism, self, labels, and all of those divisive factors that enter into the field of existence and which are utterly unnecessary for it. May all beings see into the nature of things. May all beings love the fullness of listening. May all beings be liberated. Just have a couple of quiet minutes, please.